All right. Thanks, everyone, for coming. Today is Friday, April 12th, 2019. It's 1:30 p.m., and this is panel 4403, entitled When Heroes Fall, The Ethical Considerations of Consuming Art When an Artist Has a Harmful Personal History. Can we separate art from the artists? My name is Eric Budd. I'll be the moderator today. I live here in Boulder. I'll introduce the two panelists. First panelist is September Penn. She is a singer, songwriter, and recording artist. September is the CEO and artistic director and co-founder of The Power of Song Incorporated, which is a 501c3 nonprofit organization that mentors youth while educating them about social justice issues through song. Through song, theater, and art. Mm-hmm. September is working on another CD to be released this year with focusing on soul and social justice. Mm-hmm. Josh Larson is our second panelist today. He is the co-host of the radio show and podcast Film Spotting, author of Movies Are Prayers, and editor and film critic at Think Christian, a website focus exploring faith and pop culture. Josh is also a lead of Ebert Interruptus and has been at the Conference on World Affairs since 2017, which will be showing the last segment of WALL-E this afternoon at 3:30 p.m. in the Mackey Auditorium. So, a few notes about asking questions at the panel today. In this CWA session, we will use both the CWA app and the note card system to receive questions from the audience. To ask a question in the app, simply select the session for the schedule, tap Q&A, and then insert and send your question. You may also raise your hand to request a note card and pencil from one of the producers. You must write legibly. And if you are a student or attending remotely, please note this in your question. And please make your questions brief and to the point. And then one other note is that there was a party scheduled on the Hill today at 4:30 p.m. That party has been canceled, just so you know, due to the weather.
Mm-hmm. The party.
The party on the Hill for the conference, yeah. Now that I've introduced the topic, we'll have each of the panelists start off with a 5-minute statement on how they have researched the topic and try to bring their personal experience into the topic at hand. So please take it away, September.
So this is a tricky topic. I'm just going to read the description again. The ethical considerations of consuming art when an artist has a harmful personal history. Can we separate art from the artist? And that's just difficult because some of the very best art that I have witnessed, heard, has come from tortured souls. It's come from people who have struggled within themselves for many, many years over, you know, whatever family issues, whether it's drugs or, but still they're able to produce, you know, something that speaks so deeply to so many people. It resonates on a level that possibly an artist who hasn't had these types of experience could even penetrate. So, and I'm not justifying anything. I'm just saying it is what it is. It's still a lot of beauty. There's a lot of passion that comes through those artists who have these types of experiences. And I try not to be someone who cast a lot of judgment. And yeah, I know we're going to talk about the R. Kellys. We're going to talk about Bill Cosby. We're going to talk about people whom we loved and the work that they've done. But just even myself, I try to be careful to cast a whole lot of judgment. Some of you may have seen an Ivan Penn running around here. He's an investigative reporter. There's something that Ivan says all the time, that whenever he is starting a job, whether he's investigating a politician or a community official, whoever, if he digs deep enough on anybody, even your mother, he's going to find some dirt. So all of us truly, but for the grace of God, not to say that we've just fallen so hard, but all of us have something that we've struggled with at some point in life that we don't want everybody to know. And these artists are living so publicly, and their lives, even just with this digital age, their lives are on full display. We see their falls so much. It's more obvious. So that's one of the first things I do want to say, just to, as far as being careful about trying to hold them so directly under the, you know, that lens. And even when you look at these artists, I think about Michael Jackson, I think about R. Kelly. I heard one commentator say, now is this a harmless, troubled genius, or is it a cold, calculated predator? I mean, some of them truly may have, you know, there may be a vindictive spirit there that needs, you know, maybe there does need to be some judgment there. But I don't know if I can be the one to speak and say, but I'm not answering the question. I think when it comes to their art itself, we still have to, it's a true self-reflection of it. I certainly can't toss out all the art that I've been able to share and to receive from many of these artists. So honestly, my last word would be, but for the grace of God, go I.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for not answering the question, because I don't think that there is one. And the way you've wrestled with it is, you know, I've experienced it similarly, especially when it comes to the art from some of these names that have been mentioned. The one project that I am involved in, Think Christian, does involve a podcast where we talk about faith and pop culture. And we did an episode recently. We called it Separating the Art from the Sinner. Mm-hmm. And so I'm coming at this from kind of a particular vantage point that you might find helpful, maybe not. And it has to do, you know, often humans are described, we can look at humans and have a high anthropology or a low anthropology, a vision of them as superior beings who are inherently good, or fallen beings who are inherently broken. And I guess, you know, I try to maintain something of a realistic anthropology, which holds both intention at the same time, which you've already alluded to, September, that these artists, the names that have been mentioned, are capable of creating great beauty, and we've also learned that they are capable of great harm in some instances. So on that episode of the Think Christian podcast, we did focus on Michael Jackson, R. Kelly, worth noting, you know, allegations at this point in those instances, and then also someone like Louis C.K., where he has admitted to impropriety, and what we found in that one episode is that we had different responses and ways of thinking about it for each figure, because they are all individuals and these are individual situations. So one framework that we used there that was somewhat helpful was to take some ideas, some biblical ideas, and ask how does this help us move forward when these instances arise? And I think there are probably four steps that ideally are taken when an artist falls, and the first would be confession. Mm. We would hope for confession, true confession. The second would be justice. I don't think, you know, there's an element of there where you don't just say, I don't think Christianity would just say, well, if you've admitted to something, it's okay. You should be okay. Justice should still be an element of this. And if that is found, then perhaps then you can move towards forgiveness. And then the ultimate hope would that there might be able to be some reconciliation. It doesn't mean that each of these steps have to take place. Sometimes it's not possible, especially when the victims are, you know, when you're considering the victims in these situations. And again, depending on each person, this may not be helpful. So R. Kelly and Michael Jackson, there hasn't been confession.
That's right.
Michael Jackson is no longer alive, and there's a complicating factor in that. Louis C.K. has, what I've always loved about his comedy is that it is deeply confessional, and then we found out maybe it wasn't confessional enough. He offered a confession, ran, I think it was an opinion piece in the New York Times, I believe, and part of that was saying, I'm going to give this a lot of time and you know, think about this. And that was maybe about a year ago, and now he's outperforming. I have not seen any of his stand-up acts, so I can't say this exactly, but reports are that, you know, he's using what happened as bits in a way that seems not quite so confessional. And so what do we do with this? Where is he? You know, how can forgiveness be extended there? What is justice there? What does justice mean for Michael Jackson's accusers, who the HBO documentary revealed to be very convincing? So, I'm not going to answer it either.
Yeah.
So, as September was saying, if you look hard enough at anyone and dig deep enough, you can find anything, essentially, is my paraphrase of it. And what do you think it is about this day and age that this topic seems to be very front and center? Is it social media? Is it the changing in the press? Why is this timely? And what's going on that kind of makes this a pressing topic? And whoever wants to jump in and answer this, feel free.
Well, I think for some reason it's timely because it's pressing because so much is just rising up. So much is being shared. The whole Me Too movement with people coming forward. I think because we always do want a hero. We want the heroes. And it causes, you know, great disappointment when people start falling. But if you have victims who have, you know, been silent for so many years and finally someone comes out and they're seeing maybe there's a hint, a possibility of justice there, it's going to draw out more people. I said earlier about the whole digital age, the fact that everything is being recorded, and it's easier to capture, you know, to find the evidence. It's easier for people to come forward now. They just seem to be coming. Even when you go back and look at years ago, which he's still sitting as a judge, but the whole Clarence Thomas case, when that came out, and Anita Hill, when she came forward, all of those years went by before she came forward. And I remember at that point in history, culturally, in the African-American community, we were kind of trained, no, you cover each other, you protect each other. So I remember when Anita Hill first came out, it was like, what are you doing? Why are you outing this man? He's one of ours. But she had the right to come out. If she had been intruded upon, she had, however it turned out, if she felt within herself there was, she'd been accosted, she had the right to open her mouth and speak her truth as she knew it, whoever believed it. So I think people are speaking their truth. They're becoming more brave. They're becoming more available and just opening their mouth and leaning in and speaking up.
It's interesting you bring that up because, you know, in some ways, we just went through this again with the Kavanaugh mm-hmm. nomination. And, you know, I do remember the Anita Hill news, and it seems like this was even more around us and ever present
yes.
because of digital media. But, you know, whether or not it should be the case, we ended up kind of in the same place, didn't we?
Indeed.
That it's just interesting to think about that. Given the other element I would add is, yes, I would say digital media is making us more aware. It's also a force for galvanizing and corralling outrage, mm-hmm. and in many cases, justified outrage. Saw that with Kavanaugh, but again, to what end? There was a lot more noise. But I think that element is why we do hear more about these cases more frequently, is there are campaigns, there are hashtags, there is Mute R. Kelly, mm-hmm. Which is, you know, an active attempt to squash any, you know, sales of his music, booking of him for concerts.
Yeah.
He essentially had to try to book concerts overseas because he couldn't here in the States. So there are definite effects that those sorts of social media campaigns have. And I think that's maybe why it seems more omnipresent as well.
And, the victims don't feel alone. That's one reason why people stay quiet, because they feel like, I'm going to be the only one who says something. And if they see that there's a community, there are people rising up, it gives them, you know, it empowers them to at least open their mouths. Yeah.
Why, as individuals who are consumers of art, so, what is it, why do we get so emotionally connected to the artist and the art? What is it, because it feels like, as an individual, when we learn something about someone who maybe had a work or a writing or a song that really was formative in the development of our person, that it's so emotionally hard to even process it. I can think of some instances of my own where I still haven't really come to terms with it. What can you say about that process of connecting with artists, and what can we do? And maybe that's just the way it is. It's kind of like falling in love. I'm just trying to explore that topic. And what do you think?
I know we've mentioned R. Kelly a few times, but I'll just share my personal thing. I remember growing up, I listened to his music. And, you know, it was dance music, so you were dancing. But as I got a little bit more mature and I would listen to the actual lyrics, I mean, the lyrics themselves were telling on him, you know. If you go back and just listen, age ain't nothing but a number, come on. He was telling on himself. So as he continued to be popular, I remember when I made the conscious choice to pull away, to kind of withdraw from him, to the point that even when he continued putting his music out, I would actually cringe when it would come on the radio. I would do this kind of weird knee-jerk response, like, ugh, oh my God, he's still there, he's still doing it, knowing what was going on, you know, maybe backstage or in his private hotel rooms. For me, it became an immediate disgust. And I don't want to just, you know, kind of flip-flop as far as, you know, casting that judgment on him, but I think it all really depends on the crime. When you're talking about underage girls, I mean, he's doing pedophilia. That crime is so crass to unprotected, you know, minors, that causes the stigma to be even greater. So for me, with that particular artist, there is no separation from the art and the artist. There are some artists that I can listen to the song, I can see the artwork, there's separation, but because I do know the crime, the details of the crime, I mean, it's all kind of, to me, it's all mesh and meh. Yeah, I have no good feelings towards that particular art form that he produces anymore.
It seems to me music is maybe the most difficult in terms of that element, and the personal connection we have to music, and how it seems so tied in often cases to the musician themselves. Mm-hmm. I love that idea of telling on himself, because it brings us back to this idea of confession.
Yeah.
Is there a subliminal attempt at confession there? You can look at some of Michael Jackson's music the same way, I think, or even something like Thriller, which is all about dual identities. And the way he was, his whole life seemed to be struggling with identity, mm-hmm. and you know, being childish in some ways and overtly adult sexual in other ways, and all of that can be read as confessional in retrospect, I think. But yeah, going back to music, that's maybe the most difficult to make that personal separation, if you feel that's what should take place. For me, it may seem weird, but that was my experience with the Louis C.K. stuff, is because, as I said, I just so appreciated that what I thought was raw honesty that he was projecting in his comedy, and that someone would use comedy that way. You know, it was just so refreshing to me, and I thought that he was digging at some really important truths and exposing a lot of stuff, ironically, about masculinity, exposing himself as the failings that he saw in himself that he struggled with, and how they represented you know, the fact that we are all fallen in some way, and there was almost like a connection there that I felt that I would compare to what some people would feel with a singer-songwriter. Mm-hmm. So when all of this came out, I wouldn't have expected to feel betrayed. Like, why do I feel betrayed by a stand-up comedian I've never met?
Yeah.
It was really weird to have that emotional response. But that's what it was. And I think that speaks to how tightly connected we can get to the art. Mm-hmm. And wrap that up with the artists as well. It makes me think of whenever, and I used to be this way when I was like high school age, and whenever I speak to high school groups about film, about movies, I always have to pause before we begin and remind myself that at this age, and again, I was this way too, when they're talking about a movie they love, there is very little separation between that movie and their own identity.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's how passionately we love things when we're younger, especially art. And so if I'm going to say something bad about, you know, Transformers or whatever I think is a piece of junk, the kid in that audience who loves Transformers thinks I'm saying something bad about him or her. And I think we all do that to a degree. So that same phenomenon when it happens with artists who take a fall, that's why it can hurt, and we can feel betrayed.
Yeah, betrayal. That's a very powerful word, and that's what I felt with Bill Cosby, you know, because I grew up in the 80s watching The Cosby Show, and he was, you know, America's dad, and he was this powerful, warm African-American figure. It was positive. It was on TV. People were watching it, and I, when all of this opened up with him drugging women and abusing women sexually, I felt totally betrayed. I was like, how could you do that to me, to the families? Your representation of, you know, we finally had good positive African American images. It was horrible. I remember as it was all coming out, because even after The Cosby Show, you know, my kids grew up watching the little cartoon. You remember the little cartoon? And they go, hello, friend. And you feel so warm and kind. So someone at the office turns around the corner and says to me, hello, friend. And I was like, ugh. Mm. I had that feeling again because of what, you know, that whole feeling of betrayal of what Bill Cosby did.
Yeah. Can I ask you about that community question you brought up when it comes to Bill Cosby? Because you're right. He became such a representative icon, but also had a history of criticizing community.
Yeah.
Right?
Yes,
and so it
he
seems
did.
To me
he was, it was
like,
a love hate. It was a love hate relationship.
And then
that's
this
real.
Comes out, and that, I mean, the tendrils and the complications there had to be incredible.
Yeah, incredible. Very painful. Either people just didn't want to talk about it, or they bashed it, and they were like, "Well, he's been down on us anyway. He's been down on our young black men anyway. So we're kind of fed up with him anyway."
Okay.
Yeah, it just contributed to it.
Yeah.
So a question from the audience: as consumers, by purchasing the goods of fallen heroes, and maybe importantly their brand, especially in the age of like Instagram influencers who make their money by being out there, and it's directly feeding off of people's economic spending, we're tacitly endorsing this. Mm-hmm. And so the question is, what can we do about this? I think that immediate one is a little more obvious. We can change maybe our spending behaviors. But what do we do about some of those figures that have kind of gone past the limelight? What do we do with their art as well that's kind of out there in the world?
I think Josh spoke to it when he talked about, you know, confession. I think it is really tied to, have they confessed anything? Have they admitted it? Are they still trying to own, you know, their own innocence? Or have they admitted they're wrong? Earlier, even before we started this open conversation, we mentioned, I didn't mention it here, but we talked about even Martha Stewart. You know, Martha Stewart, the homemaker, artist homemaker, and she went to jail. But she at some point, she said, and I'm sorry. She was sorry to those in the company that she hurt. She served her time, and she fell, but we saw Martha Stewart rise again. You know, I think there's something attached to really confessing and saying that you're sorry. That and I do remember for a while, I wasn't buying Martha Stewart sheets. But as things turned around, you know, yeah, I wouldn't mind having some of her sheets in my home. but no, yeah, there are, for me personally, there are certain artists that I won't support their work. I won't support their brand. Yes, yeah.
Yeah, the money question, so this kind of came up at an event I know one or two of you were at last night where I was speaking at First Presbyterian here in Boulder. And the money question is an easy one for me to dodge because I can say, well, in my role as a critic, I'm not paying for a lot of this stuff anyway, so I can kind of, you know, wash my hands a little bit that way. But it's kind of a cheat. I mean, at some point, you know, again, for Louis C.K., the question I have to answer is if he does get a Netflix special, you know, am I going to watch it? Mm. And I don't know. I don't know. I don't think we can say this is what you should do in this case because each one is so individual. Again, I would probably watch it to see where does he seem to be at in this journey that is perhaps still an act, but perhaps it's genuine. Like maybe we still hold out. Maybe our role, if we're not a victim, I mean, I have to make that distinction as well. If we're not a victim, maybe our role can be to listen and see where someone might be at on that journey. And maybe they'll prove to be, you know, tricking us again. That's certainly possible. And of course, listen with those victims in mind. You know, always keeping in mind, how does this sound? How would this sound to them? How does this stand-up routine sound to them? So that's, you know, that's the money question. But otherwise, I think, you know, in the case like R. Kelly, if you're convinced of the allegations, and in that case as well, there's no reason not to be convinced, you know, of course you would not want to give money towards what you can trace the line there, right?
Oh, indeed.
You can buy the concert ticket or buy the album and trace the line to the check being written for the lawyer.
Yeah. Yes.
And so that's maybe an easier decision to make. But the other element of that I think is worth talking about too, your question was, what do we do with the art?
Mm-hmm.
I will say I feel a bit more strongly about this, though I could be convinced otherwise, that we don't get rid of the art. And I think because, for one thing, it may hold clues. We talked about the art being confessional. For another thing, you can't learn at all if you just try to erase something from the past, even if it may be ugly, even if some of those R. Kelly songs, you look at the lyrics and you're like, what were we all thinking? You know, but there's value in asking yourself that question and feeling that complicity. So you're probably not going to play R. Kelly at a party, but that doesn't mean you want to burn the albums. I think there's a middle ground there. And maybe it's just another way for us to remember, you know, that we're all wrestling with
yeah.
the fact that we're capable of good things and capable of terrible things. And if we try to deny that and erase the cultural products that stand as, you know, explicit evidence of human nature,
mm-hmm.
that doesn't seem to be helpful to me.
Yeah. And to kind of play off of that, how do you think time really factors into this? I think we talked a lot about confession and that is something that someone who is still living, of course, can potentially do. But what do you think some of these current instances will be recontextualized, you know, a few decades from now? Or do we think we've kind of set the narrative already?
That's a good question. I mean, I think only time itself is going to tell. 20 years from now, what are we going to be saying about R. Kelly? Are we going to be celebrating, you know, his bump and grind songs? Are we going to be celebrating even, you know, the shuffle dance tunes? I can't answer that. I hate that I can't answer these questions. I do. But I just can't answer that. You know, I look back even say for the artists who died of drug overdoses, how do we look at them? When I think of Billie Holiday, and I love Billie Holiday, I love the richness in her voice. I love that you can hear the pain and the passion with every melody that she releases. But she was so extremely tortured. She did drugs. But she was such a revolutionary individual in history. The type of music that she recorded had never been recorded ever before. When you think about Strange Fruit, which was, you know, one of the first recorded social justice songs talking about lynchings, she's wrestling with so much in her mind and her heart that, you know, I can't judge her because she had a drug overdose. God forgive me if I do that. I don't know the pains that she felt. So I cannot tell you what's going to happen 20, 30 years down the road. How are we going to look at Michael Jackson and his whole catalog, which I still love his whole catalog, which I still dance to, you know, much of his catalog. I still sing along with it. But even when I sing along with it, I'll catch myself and I'll think, ugh, I still get those weird feelings, you know. And I think that has to do with thinking of the victims. You know, I don't think of these artists without also thinking of the victims of the pain that they have also inflicted. So, again, I'm not answering the question. I'm just speaking to it.
Yeah, and in a case like Billie Holiday, where I think we can say, you know, there were personal afflictions and not necessarily direct victims in something like that, we want to remember the music. And when the art is that monumental, it will survive, for sure. Some of these cases where there are direct victims that we're talking about, I hate to say it, but if I had to bet, you know, 20, 30 years from now, people are going to remember Michael Jackson for Billie Jean or Thriller. And I mean, that is it fair to say he's as big of a cultural figure as Billie Holiday? I mean, I think so.
Oh, yeah, indeed.
If not more.
No, he is.
And
no,
so
indeed he is.
This goes back to what you said at the very start, September, when you said, we want heroes.
We do.
And there's something in us, it's that denial, I think, that we are, you know, capable of doing bad things. So we look to someone, put them on a pedestal. And so once the pain fades, the victims are forgotten, the hashtags are not used anymore. The music is still going to be there.
Mm-hmm.
The Cosby Show is still going to be on whatever streaming service,
yes,
you know, runs our lives at that point. And that's what is going to last,
yeah,
for better or for worse. So that would be my bet. I mean, so it helps maybe to look in the past and think about someone like, you know, early film star like Fatty Arbuckle, you know, accused of horrible, horrible crimes and made headlines in the day, but that's not often, you know, the first or second thing that comes up when his name is mentioned. So I think similar things will happen to some of these names we've been talking about today.
Yeah, I agree.
How do you think these conversations, especially the the really notable artists, how do you think that's affecting artists these days? And do you think, is this causing any change kind of in the culture, in the people? Like, are we internally doing anything different as artists and people to respond to this? Or is it just people being people?
I think you just said it. It's people being people,
yeah,
and they're being recorded.
Yes.
I think that's it. Yeah, yeah. I mean, we would like to think, you think about momagers, you know, moms managing their children. You think about producers trying to manage the artist's image and stuff. But it's just people being people, regardless of how clean you try to be. You know, if you're in that culture, whether you're, you know, there's the Christian industry, you know, there's the secular industry, which can be a lot, you know, a lot sketchier. But you better believe, even in the Christian industry, there's stuff going on. I've heard so many stories that have to take place, you know, after concerts, these big name gospel artists. But that's another topic. But no, it's people being people, and they're getting captured, whether on tape or the victims are rising up, they're admitting what's happening. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you would think, because of what you're saying, artists would be more aware and more careful and self-conscious. And maybe that's happening to a degree, but then you'll also see someone post something, say something idiotic on Twitter, and your first thought is, you do know there are people on Twitter.
Yes.
And that's people being people.
Yeah.
Now, the other element is, and this goes, this is when we can substitute heroes and say it crosses over to being idols.
Mm.
Someone like Michael Jackson, or R. Kelly, or Bill Cosby, or Louis C.K. in his comedy world, when you become powerful enough and you can create a bubble around your entire existence,
yeah,
and that warps your sense of what's right for you, I think, and what's, you know, allowed for you. It also warps your sense of that you're invincible. That, I mean, I didn't watch the documentary, the HBO documentary, but this Neverland compound, you know,
yeah,
some of the clips I saw, you realize one of the reasons it was built that way. And it's sickening. But it is essentially, you know, creating your own country where you could have your own laws,
yeah,
that all pertain to your sense of yourself. So that's when we have given idolatrous power over to a human being who is just a human being, even if it's Michael Jackson. And I think that's why we see it keep happening, even though you would think, back to your question, that people would be, you know, smarter about it. If smarter would be more self-protective, I guess you should say.
Yeah.
Question from the audience. Can it be empowering to take ownership of the art away from the artist as us individuals? It doesn't seem fair that I can no longer enjoy Kevin Spacey movies because he did terrible things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, another good name.
That is a good name. No, and you're right. It isn't fair. It isn't fair. They rob us of that joy, you know?
So with any of the music you've talked about, have you, when a song has come on, have you felt empowerment by reclaiming it in any way? And maybe it's too fresh for you know, an R. Kelly or Michael Jackson song.
I cannot say I've been able to claim empowerment.
Yeah.
Because I still get the reminders.
Yeah.
Like I said earlier, because I think of the victims. It's like I'll start jamming to it, enjoying it. Oh, yeah, that's right. It's like my consciousness rises every single time. So, I cannot say that I can claim empowerment and do the separation from the artist.
It's a really good question. I haven't thought about that.
Yeah.
It's a spin on, an oppressed group taking a derogatory term and claiming it for their own and using it within their own community. I'm thinking of it as something similar to that. You're taking something that that is awful at heart and finding empowerment by using it in a different way. So I see, like, maybe that's a model for approaching art from fallen artists. I'm just trying to think of what does that look like? You know, does it look like how do you empower, how do you dance to a Jackson song now with empowerment?
I know, I can't even see what that would look like.
Yeah.
You're trying to take something that has a negative connotation to it now and flip it to make it positive and powerful. I personally don't think it can be done.
Hmm.
Yeah, I think the reminders of who they are and the crime, the victims, I think that it's going to be attached to it. So maybe it'll be forgotten in 20 years or 30 years, but I don't think in this time and space that you can just, you know, take it and find empowerment in it. I don't think it's even possible.
Yeah.
Well, this one's perhaps a bit more existential. Does the fall of an artist even matter? And I think what the audience question here was really that, are these ethics important? I guess that question is really implying the full separation of the art and the artist, and that that person maybe would argue that, you know, it's just the art, and that's what matters and not the artist. Any reflections on that?
Do you want to go first?
Okay.
I think first.
You have been. I appreciate it. Thank you. I think it's pretty clear by now, I would say it matters. But I understand that position. I find it a little nihilistic, but I get it. It's cleaner, and it also honors the art, which I would argue for. You know, it's saying, listen, we're interested in the art. I do believe in the death of the author, and so I'm sympathetic to that question in that way, that when something is created, it becomes its own thing, separate from the intent of the artist. And that's easier to do with some art forms than others. And maybe, you know, songs, it's more difficult because they're often autobiographical. But yeah, I mean, it matters for me. It matters for me. I'm not... You know where I wrestle with this question? I consider basketball art. but... Others don't, but still, I think it's relevant. I struggle with this when I think about, you know, NBA players, and, you know, you learn about something that's similar, that we've talked about these artists in their personal lives. And it's easier for me, I think, to, I don't know, take a more nihilistic approach and say, I can just watch the beauty of the game, and I don't have to worry about their personal lives. So maybe I'm closer to that position than I think.
I think I'm going to take a little shift and go down a different road on this. Before I do, just read the question one more time. Yeah, because I think I know where I'm going. I just want to make sure I get there.
Well, does the fall of an artist matter?
Yeah, okay. As an artist... And this is going to be probably an existential even response, but I know I'm in my best flow when things are clear. If I really want to, and I'm speaking as a Christian artist, when I want to be used by God, whatever I'm going to project and put out there, not to say I got to be totally perfect, but things have to be clear. And has to do with whether it's forgiveness, you know, getting forgiveness for God, forgiving my brother, getting things off of my chest, just clear, because whatever it is I'm going to produce, if I'm singing, if I'm doing theater, artists are antennas, and we project whatever we carry. That's why I, in that sense, it's hard for me to separate the artist from the art itself, because whatever it is I'm going to produce, whatever comes out of me, if I want it to be honorable, I can't be living a sloppy life. That's just me. I don't know how others look at that. When I step, you know, to the contemporary with these artists and what they're producing, depending on the crime, that's why it's so difficult to separate the art itself from the artist, because when you're creatives, you're in a different, you're in a different zone. And if you're singing, music, that's one of the beautiful things about music. And also one of the damaging things about music is that the vibrations and the penetrations go so deep. So whatever it is that we are carrying in us, we're projecting that into you. I just know that. I've seen that. So I think it does matter. I think the fall of an artist, I think it does matter. I don't think we can completely separate the art from the artist and their life and what they're doing.
Can I ask a follow-up on that? Because
sure.
I think that's an important distinction between us. You're coming at it from an artist's perspective.
Yeah.
And I'm doing the critic thing. So do you think in general, and we've talked about how each case is its own, but...
Yeah.
Being an artist and understanding the process from the inside in a way that I can't, does that make you does that make you more sympathetic to someone who is struggling with their own? I mean, even if everything Michael Jackson has been accused of doing is true, and it's awful, you also know it was an awful struggle for him on some degree too. Okay, so I guess I'm asking, being an artist, do you find you're more sympathetic to that struggle in a fallen artist, or because you sounds like hold yourself to a high bar in your art, Do you also hold fellow artists to a high bar and are more, look at it that way?
I am more sympathetic, and then it also depends on the art form. And the reason why I say that is because it's always, who is your audience? Who are you trying to speak to? Who are you trying to, what is it that you're trying to convey, and where who are you trying to reach? So it is the art form. And forgive me, sometimes I'm speaking as a Christian artist. Other times it's just, I can't divide myself. But just if I'm thinking about R. Kelly or others, it matters. It matters. Even my own confession, I can listen to different songs that I've written over time, and I can remember where I was. Whether in my prayer life, in my life in general, I can remember where I was from the product that came out.
Okay.
Yeah. So I have sympathy to these artists and their struggles. That's why even when I did the very opening statement, I was like, I don't want to cast any judgment because I know what this life is like in general. Yeah, we are all just trying to make it on this green earth.
And do you think, as consumers of art, as we all are, that having been burned, having been betrayed, that in the future going forward, that also changes our perspective on what we're looking for in artists or what kind of art we consume as well? Do you see that? Do you see us being more conscious as well?
Boy, I guess. I mean, you would want to say yes, because then we haven't learned anything. And I've already argued for learning from these situations. But I also believe very strongly that you let the art speak first. And, if you go in, if you put on an album or go, into a movie or pick up a novel, and the first thing you do is Google, police reports and the persons, that's not letting the art speak. I mean, in a way, maybe you're doing your due diligence because you don't want to support people. And I guess I can understand that. But
yeah.
Wow, is that going to warp your experience with the art, which I've already suggested is its own entity beyond its authors. So how do we balance that? How do we be vigilant? Maybe we make a separation by making space for the voices who come up and make claims against artists. And maybe we, and I think the culture has shifted this way in ways you've talked about, like accusers have found community online.
Yes.
And maybe one way is not to, make sure every piece of art hits a standard based on the artist's past, but we just make sure that as a cultural community, we make more space for those who make claims against people and listen to those voices and give those claims in full investigation and not be instinctually, it goes back to feeling personal about the art, not to be instinctually, so-and-so would never do that, and protect them and circle around. It's a balance of, you want, innocent until proven guilty, but also I think we've seen that these voices are snuffed out often too quickly. So is that a way to dodge the question? I don't know. Maybe.
A question from the audience, which I think is kind of a third dimension to what we've been talking about, is can you comment on consuming art, particularly of past generations, that reflects perceivably sexist, homophobic, or racist opinions? Can we separate the work from the artist from the cultural aspects of what the artist and the generation that the artists lived through as well? How much of that are the blame of the artist or the culture that the artist grew up in?
Well, obviously, the art form is reflecting. It's reflecting the culture. It's a product of the culture itself. If it's good, it's good. The thing is, if it's good, it's good. I've listened to music, and I found out later that the person maybe was homophobic, and or maybe the person was racist, but I was still able to appreciate the art form itself. Again, I think that's a point where I don't know quite how to answer that. Yeah, because if it is good, I'm going to appreciate it. It's all in what extra information do I know about the artist, similar to what he was saying about Googling, and what is this person just? Did they do good things, or do they have a bad background? I don't know. If it's good, it's good. Yeah.
Yeah, this is a really tough one.
It is tough.
It's coming up a lot, you know, among, if you're a critic, because for good reasons, works of art from the past are being reevaluated under, I guess, what we'd call more enlightened and justifiably so perspectives. And I think that's all for the good. I think sometimes it can lend to a knee-jerk dismissal of an entire piece of art because it does have that element.
Yeah.
So I think it's most helpful to strike a balance of acknowledging what we would say, you know, is not an admirable facet, whether it's something that is sexist or racist or anything else that we would want to see in our art today, but not to condemn the entire work for that. So an example I can give is on Film Spotting, the other podcast I'm a co-host on, we will often do what we call marathons, and we look back at a director from the past or a genre from the past and just refamiliarize ourselves with them. And so we did Vincent Minnelli about a year or so ago. And one of his early films is a musical, Cabin in the Sky. And this has, you know, it's an all-African-American cast, which was a huge breakthrough at the time, but also has in it all sorts of stereotypes that obviously we would not respect in a piece of art today. So there's a balance of recognizing that, also talking about the really wonderful things in that. And one of the really wonderful things in Cabin in the Sky is the way Ethel Waters, like, pretty much takes over that movie and makes you realize that all of this stereotypical discriminatory stuff that is also a part of it is ridiculous. She's, you know what she's doing? It's empowerment. She's kind of taking those bad aspects of the movie. That's the way I've seen it happen. And with her sheer talent is saying, I'm going to expose all of this as silliness, because wait till you see what I can do when I get the microphone, when I get the dance floor. And she's the best thing about that movie. And it would be terrible to say, well, let Vincent Minnelli, you know, let's talk about the bigger movies, and let's not talk about Cabin in the Sky. It's got some awkward, there's some awkward stuff in there. Instead, let's acknowledge that, own up to that, and then celebrate what we do find is good and maybe even a little subversive in it.
Yeah.
That the audience at the time didn't realize, but probably Ethel Waters knew what she was doing.
Yeah, she was still able to make good use of that platform.
Yeah, right, yeah. Right. Yeah.
Audience question. So we talked about the how artists are in the spotlight. So the question is, can you have a private life as an artist, or as an artist or celebrity, do you take on that scrutiny, or is there any way to escape it? These are all hard questions.
Yeah. As you were asking the question, for some reason I thought of the life of Martin Luther King, who, as I've studied him, there was a point that he had to choose to become a public figure, as they were encouraging him to lead out the ministers with the Southern Christian Leadership Coalition. It was a choice. Am I going to step forward or just be a church pastor? Because he could have done that. He could have maintained a private life. He and Coretta could have had their kids, but he chose, you know, to become public. And even with him, okay, and I know maybe he's not an artist per se, but he's certainly a hero. He's a public figure, a celebrated orator, and oratory skills, you know, that's certainly a part of art. and we know even he has, you know, he had his own misgivings as the great good that he did for the African-American community moving forward in the civil rights movement. He had his own, you know, the FBI did their own research and they dug up his misgivings. Even his own private life was on display. So can our artists have a private life? I think they have the right to have a private life. I think as an artist, even if you are a public figure, you have a right to take the hat off and to relax and to be who you are. But you certainly do that, because if you're always living completely in the public, you know, in the public sphere, you're going to go completely crazy. And I think that's what's happening to so many of these artists, that they are always out there, and they're that's what leads them, you know, to the alcohol and everything. But yeah, I think they have the right to have a private life. Now, am I saying they have the right to do, you know, whatever dirty deeds in their private life? I'm not saying that, but certainly they do have a right to have a private life. Yeah.
Yeah, that makes sense to me. It gets difficult because when the art is so intertwined with their private life,
yes,
I think.
Yeah.
And so this depends what sort of art form we're talking about to a degree. Depends on the artist. Brings me back to Louis C.K. I mean, you know, maybe I was falsely taking, you know, especially on his television show, Louis, you know, the Louis of Louis, always understanding it's not really Louis C.K., but it's a lot of Louis C.K. Well, how much, you know, that's... It's more difficult there. Like, does he have a right to be, you know? But it was like Louis C.K. was like, he was arguing for a way to live in mm-hmm. his art and admitting that he fell short of that way to live, but still arguing for it. And then in his personal life, he was falling a lot shorter. So it goes back to, is that his right? Is that his right to, like, project something aspirational in his art? Like, this is the guy I'd like to be.
Yeah.
He's not perfect, but he's a better guy than I am. And so that's how I'm using art, is, like, to kind of maybe get there. But then if he's hurting people along the way, it doesn't justify it.
This is a question from a student that's maybe a slight deviation from our topic, but I think... worthy to talk about. Should we feel guilty about appreciating art that we know stems from painful experiences? And I think this is a question about separating the art and the artist as well, but and not necessarily that the artist has done something in particular, but rather knowing the depression or the tragic circumstances of the art and how that plays into our perception of the art, especially terrible things that happen to people.
Well, I now feel guilty. Because I hadn't thought about this, but you were bringing up Billie Holiday, and I'm realizing often I'll put on her music to relax. Mm-hmm. It's just, for me, it's that kind of music. You know, it's like an end of the day. What had to be done is done. Like, just can kind of soak in this music. But if it arose out of all that pain, is that sort of like disrespecting the pain that the music came out of?
No, I don't think so. I don't think we have to feel guilty, and I don't think it's disrespecting it. If anything, it's honoring and recognizing it. Yeah. Because she's speaking from a human condition, and she's speaking to us mm-hmm. in our human condition. I would dare say it shows that everyone, not to say everyone's dealing with depression, but everyone has their own issue. It's real music, it's soul music, it's speaking to the rawness of our humanity. So I think we have to appreciate that.
Mm-hmm. Well, thanks. We've received a lot of questions. I think in a lot of ways we touched on a lot of the topics that people are really interested in. So I'm just curious if any final thoughts.
We didn't answer anything.
We talked
about everything.
Has this been helpful at all? I don't know that it has.
Yeah, and I think what you're really reflecting on is the personal struggle that we all have when we encounter this situation. And mm-hmm. sometimes the best thing is just to talk about our feelings and explore it and move on until the next time.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you so much for participating.
Thank you.
September Penn and Josh Larson, yeah, thank you. So.
Thank you very much. I'm going to make a last plug for Ebert Interruptus, since I think we got a minute or two here. 3:30 coming up, about an hour, we'll be in Mackey Auditorium. And if you're unfamiliar with it, this is where tradition established by Roger Ebert many, many years ago. We break down a movie, the same movie, over 4 days. So we started on Tuesday. We've got 19 minutes left of WALL-E, so I think we're going to make it. And anyone who attends can yell out stop at any moment and make a comment, ask a question. We'll have a few other fun things today since we're almost at the end. I'm going to show some behind-the-scenes stuff and maybe a clip from one of the movies that inspired WALL-E. So it's a lot of fun if you've never attended. So 3:30, Mackey Auditorium.
I'll do a plug too, okay? Find me on Instagram or Facebook. Look for my CD come out a little bit later this year, Soul and Social Justice. Thank you.
Thanks for coming.